Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ahead of the jobs report tomorrow, what it means to be out of work for a long, long time. How to celebrate the Federal Reserve, should you so choose. And Supersize Me No More in New York City. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the last day of May 2012. The next big marker on the state of the American economy lands tomorrow morning at 8:30 Washington time, the May unemployment reports. And I could guess how many jobs we added last month or what the employment rate might turn out to be. No upside in that for me, really. But there is going to be one number in tomorrow's report that we can pretty much guarantee. Long-term unemployment will be somewhere above 40%. That's more than 5 million people out of work for 6 months or more, many of whom have already lost federal unemployment benefits. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out how they've been getting by.
If you want to find unemployed people, go where they've got the unemployment benefits. That's the state unemployment office.
Okay, so let's.
This one is in a lower middle class neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, where I meet Alan Kern. He's 62 with four grown children and a few grandkids as well.
I was a pastor and a missionary for many years and writing a novel and actually going over my novel and editing it here.
Not just editing the novel about his missionary work in Africa, also scanning the help wanted listings. Kern lost his job last year when his church closed its doors, and because Congress cut back on long-term jobless benefits, he's only getting 6 months of unemployment insurance. It pays $700 a month, and it's about to run out.
If that gets cut off, then I don't know what we're going to do.
Public policy professor Carl Van Horn has a pretty good guess what he'll do, though. Van Horn runs the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. He's been following a sample group of long-term unemployed people since 2009.
The majority of them sold possessions, missed payments on their mortgages or credit cards. One in five moved in with another family member. A very large percentage borrowed money from friends or family or even their adult children.
So I asked Kern,
what about family or friends? I mean, would you ever go to that point?
Yeah, well, I did go to that point with my son, who's in the military. He supported us for a while a few years back. That would be a last resort. It comes a point where, you know, you kind of lose self-respect.
And Kern says with his wife making around $1,700 a month at a florist's shop, more government assistance is out of reach. Van Horn says Kern is probably right.
Government programs, almost all of them are means-tested. You have to have fairly low income and assets before you're qualified.
But more and more people are qualifying. Take food stamps. In 2007, the number of Americans getting food stamps was 26 million. Last year, it was 44 million. Wynette Dodson is one of them. She's another of the long-term unemployed people I met at the Portland Job Center. Dodson's 59. She got laid off as a drug and alcohol counselor back in 2010. She had been getting $34 per month in food stamps. Then her unemployment insurance ran out.
So now it's boosted up to $180. You have to budget. I can manage pretty well, household manage.
But all the good housekeeping in the world couldn't replace $1,056 a month in unemployment checks. Dodson says her daughter has a good job as a bus driver.
My baby girl, she steps in and helps her mom out and my church that I belong to. And I just applied for SSI because I do have a medical disability.
SSI, that stands for Supplemental Security Income. It's a Social Security program that pays people who can't work full-time because they're blind or disabled. Dodson has diabetes. Since the recession hit, applications for SSI have spiked, and the number of new recipients is up more than 30%. That's among workers who are already close to retirement, and also among the age group you'd least expect, 18 to 34-year-olds in their prime earning years. Carl Van Horn says SSI is one way people are replacing income after unemployment runs out if they can qualify with a disability. But he says for younger workers, it's a dangerous road.
Because they've labeled themselves as unable to work, getting disability benefits is often a one-way street. It's very hard to come back into the labor market once you've gone in that direction.
Wynette Dodson isn't worried about that. She says after 2 years without work, she'll take whatever comes.
It is a very long time. And sometimes I get frustrated. Sometimes I just want to throw my hands up, but I got to keep going.
More than 400,000 people have already run out of benefits this year as their long-term unemployment insurance ended. More will follow as states reduce the length of time people can stay on the rolls. Then they'll be scrambling for jobs and other government benefits as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As happens most months, right before the jobs report comes out, traders on Wall Street today were just biding their time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever the May unemployment report turns out to be, it's probably not going to be great news for the Rust Belt. Best guesses are manufacturing jobs are still scarce out there. Meanwhile, new economy places like Silicon Valley continue to thrive. The difference is location, location, and location. So says economist Enrico Moretti in his latest book. It's called The New Geography of Jobs. Mr. Moretti, it's good to have you on the program.
It's good to be with you.
Now, I thought digital technology and telecommuting and all of that meant that distance was dead, right? And geography with jobs didn't really matter.
Well, actually, the opposite is true.
Really?
Geography matters more and more. In fact, if you look at the economic map of America today, you don't see just one country. You see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like San Francisco or Seattle, Austin or Raleigh, with a strong innovation-based economy and a labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid on the globe. At the other extreme, you see cities like Detroit or Cleveland or Flint with a shrinking population and shrinking salaries. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country, which appears undecided on which direction to take.
You know, it's interesting. So you mentioned San Francisco and Seattle and then Detroit and some of the Rust Belt cities. And the thing that pops to my mind when you say that is the income and wealth disparity between those two different kinds of cities. And I wonder if the mobility that you talk about in this book, about how that's important to be able to get a new job, that mobility is sort of slanted against the poor, right? Because if you're poor, you can't just get up and go and find a job.
That's right. There are enormous differences in the propensity to relocate for American workers. Almost half of college graduates move out of their birth state by age 30, and a lot of it has to do with the ability of seeking better economic conditions in different cities.
Yeah. Say that again. Half of college graduates move out of their birth state by the time they're 30.
Almost half of college graduates move out of their birth state by the age of 30.
That's kind of amazing, actually, isn't it?
It is. And it's even more amazing when you compare it with the mobility rate of high school graduates or high school dropouts.
So they stay, right? They probably stay in their hometowns.
They do. You know, the lower mobility of less educated Americans has large economic cost. Mm-hmm. If the less educated people were more able and more willing to move to cities with better job opportunities, the gap between college graduates and high school graduates would shrink.
Let me get you to the geography of this thing for a second, in keeping with the title of the book. How did Silicon Valley become Silicon Valley and the center of high-tech innovation in this country? I mean, it and with apologies to those who are listening, you've got 128 in Boston, Route 128, and you've got Virginia outside Washington, D.C. that has AOL. But those places are a distant second to Silicon Valley. How did that happen?
And it's not that the one in Silicon Valley is smarter or works longer hours. It's the entire ecosystem that surrounds him that is different, and in particular, the number of highly educated workers. You know, new ideas and successful innovation are rarely born in isolation. Economic research shows that being around smart people make us more innovative and more productive, and ultimately, companies are willing to pay for that higher degree of innovation and productivity. We live in an economy where talent has become one of the scarcest resources.
Human capital, right?
Human capital is the key to success, both for cities as well as for companies.
Enrico Moretti is a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called The New Geography of Jobs. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We've got an excerpt from The New Geography of Jobs on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. The Fed turns 100 years old next year. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 gave us the central bank and more congressional briefings about monetary policy than you can shake a stick at. But to mark its centennial, the Fed wants to be known for more than just that. So it's seeking suggestions on what to include in a new archive. Marketplace's David Gura did some calling around on that.
Let's just say a Fed watcher's wish list is probably different from yours and mine. Phil Swagel teaches at the University of Maryland.
It would be fascinating to see not just the minutes, but the memos, the internal memos of the Fed, say in 1928 and 1929.
John Sylvia is the chief economist at Wells Fargo.
Well, I'd love to see the Fed's forecast for economic activity and inflation over the years.
These guys dream about documents, but they'll admit there's more to the Fed's history than that. Sylvia remembers how obsessed economists used to be with Alan Greenspan's black briefcase.
How big that briefcase was, and, you know, did the size of the briefcase really make any difference in terms of policy?
Maybe it deserves a place in the archives. And let's remember, Fed policymakers do have personalities. Hamilton College economist Ann Owen reminds us Greenspan liked to play tennis.
You could put a video of one of his tennis matches in, or perhaps even, you know, a tennis racket or tennis ball from one of his games.
Over the years, the Fed has been controversial, and Williams College economics professor Ken Kuttner says it's gotten its share of hate mail. In the 1970s, Paul Volcker tried to tackle inflation. He raised interest rates to double digits, and the housing market came to a standstill.
Out-of-work builders would send 2x4s to the Board of Governors.
And if one of those 2x4s doesn't make it into the archive, Kuttner says the Fed is rumored to have sent replies to some of those builders. And that's the correspondence he'd like to see. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The European news of the day is more political than economic. Ireland is voting on whether to agree to the EU's fiscal stability treaty, an agreement that had been seen before the latest recurrence of Greek and Spanish drama as a way out of the debt crisis over there. Today, it's our way into the story in a new episode of
What's Up?
What's Up?
What's Up, Europe?
That makes me laugh every time. Louise Williams is in Dublin. We caught her between updates on Irish radio. Louise, it's good to have you with us.
Hello, how are you? Greetings from a very grey Dublin.
Grey Dublin, good. Isn't it always grey in Dublin, by the way?
No, we've just had a period of sunshine, and maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, but the rain has descended upon us in the last few days. The last few days of campaigning for the referendum, and the actual referendum being held today. It's really, really glum outside.
Well, let's remind people what this referendum's about. It's the referendum in Ireland on the European Fiscal Treaty, which is supposed to solve all the problems, right?
Problems? I don't think this is going to solve anybody's problems. I mean, it's really interesting. If you look at it in the context of problems, people are saying a vote for yes is a vote out of fear, and a vote for no is a vote of anger. I don't really think that solves anybody's problems any which way, and neither of the votes comes from a very positive place, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have said, would there be an option of voting yes or no, or yes, but...
We'd like to have that option here sometimes, but it does. A yes vote on this referendum would get Ireland access to European bailout money should it need it, right?
Well, should it need it? And should the treaty not be changed by France? But look, there are so many and ifs, but ifs involved in this treaty. We don't really know if what we're voting for is what's going to be actually respected in the long term. You know, it may be shifted along the way. And that's, I suppose, the nature of the European Union. You never, you know, you're in coalition with a whole bunch of other parties who have other interests. And those interests are becoming more and more disparate.
I wonder if the Irish think, you know, they've had their moment in the bailout spotlight. It was not pleasant, but now everybody's paying attention to Spain and Greece and the Italians. Do you feel maybe you dodged a little bit of a bullet and you've done your thing and now you can move on?
No. That's the truth of it. Absolutely not. It's very likely we're going to need, call it a bailout, call it whatever you want, but it's very likely we're going to need more money ourselves. This is, you know, this is the reality. It's freefall. We don't know what's going on. And I don't really think, have a huge amount of confidence that our politicians across Europe, and obviously I'm talking about in Ireland, yeah, really know what's going on either.
That makes me about as glum as the weather you're having.
No, don't. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring you down. But it is, you know, You're right. It's really rare to get some sunshine, some rays of sunshine in Ireland, and it is an awful disappointment. Of course, everybody's speculating. Does this rainy weather mean that the no vote will be stronger? Does this rainy weather mean that the yes vote will be stronger? So we sort of got meteorologists competing with political analysts on the airwaves to figure out how the vote's going to go.
Louise Williams in Dublin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up,
we have right now 7 out of 10 Americans who say it's a good time to buy a house.
Perceptions and real estate reality. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrial sputtered across the finish line today, a 26-point loss, 0.2%. The blue chips wrapped up at 12,393. The NASDAQ stumbled 10 points, 0.3%. 28-27 was the closing number there. The S&P 500 whittled off 2 points, not quite 0.25% to finish, 1310 if you're keeping track. Facebook regained some, let's say it, face today with a 5% rally. But investors ganged up on Groupon, discounting that stock's value by more than 4%. Shares of Netflix streamed nearly 6% lower today. Flight to safety sent bond prices higher. That pushed the yield on 10-year T-notes to 1.56%. Yes, how low indeed can it go? You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases employment data for May. The Commerce Department reports on personal income as well as construction spending for April. And June 1st marks the official beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season. If you live in Florida or the Gulf Coast, might be time to get your emergency kit in order. I'm Gina Delbach.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. With the American housing market going the way it has the past couple of years, we will take our good news where it comes. Earlier this week, the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index reported a very slight gain in home prices, a scant 0.1%. Not great, but you know how we are, right? The facts say one thing, we think another.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup, is here every week to give us an attitude check, what Americans really think about the news of the week, which today flies in the face of those facts that I mentioned. Frank, it's good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Kai.
I want to make sure I'm reading your data right. More people in this country believe home values are going to go up than they are going to go down. Do I have that right?
That's right. 33%, yes, home prices in my area are going to go up. 23% down. Back to 2005, we had 70% saying prices were going to increase.
All right, so extrapolate for me, just because there's been some buzz this week with the Case-Shiller numbers and all the rest of it, that somehow we have approached a housing bottom. Do people believe more broadly that housing is at least not going down any farther? Do you know that?
We have right now 7 out of 10 Americans who say it's a good time to buy a house. So that's a good sign as well in terms of these perceptions, which, of course, are very important because you have to perceive the reality for the reality to become real.
Whoa, that's very Zen, man.
Very Zen-esque, but it's a key principle of social psychology, regardless of what Case-Shiller tells us and all that. If people don't think prices are going to go up, they're not going to go buy houses.
Right. Does that imply that if people are interested in buying houses again, that they actually will? I mean, is there execution in addition to that aspiration?
Well, that's an interesting question, and for that we would need to look at the actual data that are out there because we don't know. What we're measuring here is kind of the environment, the context, as it were, that buying could take place in. We do know one thing empirically. We say, do you own a house? And that's at 62%. And, Kai, that's as low as we have seen it since we've been asking that question. So actual home ownership is down. Where it will go in the future, we're going to wait and see.
What about, Frank, this whole issue of people owing more on their homes than they're worth, whether they're underwater or not? Is it still a sizable chunk of the American housing market?
Well, it's pretty negative. In the good old days in 2006, 92% of Americans who owned a home said it is worth more than I paid for it. Hmm. Now it's 53% who say it's worth more, but 43% say it's worth less. A lot of those are underwater, we make a presumption. And a lot of those, by the way, are younger homeowners based on our data.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. There's more about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
JCPenney had a big sale last Friday, just in time for Memorial Day weekend. Nothing out of the norm there, except that back in January, Penney said it was done with sales. The new strategy from a new CEO is going to be low prices all the time, with sales, quote unquote, only on certain special occasions. Well, now it seems everything is special. Penney's announced a larger than expected quarterly loss this month, in part because consumers pretty much expect to see those big sale signs. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains.
First of all, let's get JCPenney's new pricing strategy straight. We had the company's CEO, Ron Johnson, on our morning show back in February.
We don't run any more like daily, weekly, week-long, or hourly events. We run 12 events a year, which are called a month.
Johnson means no more sales, except for what JCPenney calls Best Price Fridays twice a month. Today, the chain said it's adding more Best Price Fridays, but denied it's changing its strategy, except that it sounds like it is.
Well, now their basic proposition is they're not going to have sales except for when they have sales.
Ken Homa teaches marketing at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
I don't know how they can possibly communicate that clearly to any consumers.
Especially since the recession conditioned us to expect sales. Before its new pricing strategy, JCPenney had almost 600 sales a year. Jean-Pierre Dubé teaches pricing strategies at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
You've just spent decades at a place like JCPenney training your customers to wait for sales, training your customers to look for sale signs and promotional signs, all these things that cue them to knowing there's a deal. You've trained them to do this, and all of a sudden that all disappears.
And as JCPenney is finding out, so do many shoppers. Sears tried getting rid of sales in the 80s. It spent $110 million on advertising, but not long after, it brought back sales. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
How you feel about New York City today might well hinge on whether you're a soda drinker or not. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has a new idea to make New Yorkers healthier. Broadly speaking, it goes like this. No more big gulp soft drinks. New Yorkers being an outspoken bunch, we asked a couple of them what they think about that today.
I don't think it's necessarily, you know, a bad thing.
You don't need to have no supersized drink. 32-ounce drink is ridiculous.
You just go next door to the drugstore and get your soda before you go into the movie theater.
I think you have to target a lot of sweet drinks, not just soda.
Businesses will be more upset than people because they make so much money off that.
That was Steve Cage, Daisy Rivera, and Julian Ellis Smith in New York City today. Heidi Moore is our New York bureau chief. She is on the Marketplace soda desk this afternoon. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So listen, what exactly does the mayor want to do here? It's not just big gulps, right?
Right, exactly. So he wants to prevent New Yorkers from buying any sugary drink that's bigger than 16 ounces. So that's soda, sweetened tea, coffee, energy drinks, but not if they're low calorie. So diet soda is okay, fruit juice, milkshakes, anything alcoholic. And it's okay if you buy it in a convenience or a grocery store. So obviously it's really controversial. I mean, this is New York. This is America, right? The ability to mainline sugary drinks is like a human right. And so a lot of businesses aren't really happy about this because it's also an economic issue. They make a lot of their money off these cheap sodas.
Right. It's delis, fast food places, movie theaters, all of that stuff, right?
Right. Their whole system is that they buy concentrate and they add water to it. So their markup is something like 600%. And their profit on these concessions, the food and the soda, is like 85%. So it costs them nothing to add more water and they get to charge us more. So just as a patron, I'm constantly locked in a battle with movie theaters because I ask for a small soda and I get this giant
get a bucket,
sloshy
right? Yeah.
Vat of Coke that's bigger than my head. So I stopped by a movie theater today to talk to some people. You can tell it's a sensitive subject. I got kicked out. But
Wow, yeah,
but the thing is, New Yorkers appreciate value. I talked to Orly Santo. She's an artist. Just before she was getting ready to see a movie, she had skipped the grocery store to get more soda. This is what she told me.
Wow. I didn't buy a soda downstairs when I was thirsty, and I waited because I know I'm going to get like a bottle here, like a 2-liter bottle in one cup, which is refillable.
Right. And so the movie theater gives her a giant refillable cup. And what's more, Bloomberg gives her a reason to complain. And New Yorkers love to complain. So at least we can thank him for giving us some fodder for the next few weeks.
Yeah, says the native New Yorker. Let me ask you about New York City politics. The way things are set up, there's no doubt this is actually going to happen, right? Or is there some doubt?
Yeah, no, I think it's probably going to happen. Bloomberg's been really successful with his other bans on trans fats and things like that. I mean, he's definitely our dietitian in chief. And, you know, and this should happen by next March. So you can hoard your soda before then.
Should you so choose. Heidi Moore in New York City for us today. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
See ya.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, more evidence that General Motors is doing something different marketing-wise. We've already told you it dropped its paid ads on Facebook, and it's not going to spend $4 million for a 30-second Super Bowl ad. Today, they go to the dark side, to soccer. GM said today Chevrolet is signing on as a key sponsor of the English football club Manchester United. A 5-year deal, exact financial terms not disclosed. GM said it's trying to appeal to a more global customer base, and so, interestingly, the deal was announced in... No, not Detroit, not Manchester. Anybody? Anyone? Shanghai. Go figure that one out. All right. While you're thinking, we got to go. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow kept a disappointing month, a slide of 26 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ gave back another 10 points, a 3% there. The S&P 500 trimmed 2 points, nearly a 0.25%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.